So, as many of you know, I like to cycle to make my way around. You might have seen me on my bike going here and there. It gets me exercising, gets me in the fresh air. I love it. When it comes to maintenance, my bike, not quite so keen. I can do the simple things. I can do the pumping up of the tyres. I can do the oiling of the chain. When it comes to gears and brakes and things like that, this feels a little bit too much like hard work to me. I'm a bit less motivated to maintain those parts. Anyway, a few months ago, both my gears and my brakes were getting pretty bad. They were declining pretty fast. It got to the point where I had to anticipate where I wanted to brake about 20 metres ahead, put my brakes on, and then by the time I turned, I was slowed down. And I started thinking, actually, this is probably a risk to my life, but neither of my brakes worked really well. If I'm not going to service my bike myself, I'll get someone else to do it. So I did, got the brakes, renewed, new gears, and it was like getting a new bike. It was amazing. The brakes actually worked. I pulled them and they stopped. Anyway, I told Hans quite how bad it got. I think I did die a couple of times. A few days after my bike service, I was cycling away from my office. I'd go round the corner, and I was doing my mental checklist that you do when you leave somewhere and have got everything. Phone, wallet, keys, the three things. I realised I left my phone on the table. So annoyed myself. So I'll need that, I have to turn and get it. I did the thing that you do instinctively when you know you've forgotten something and you're a bit frustrated with yourself. I slammed the brakes on, forgetting that my bike had just been serviced. Even worse, I braked and turned at the same time. Slammed on as hard as I could. My bike stopped dead, and I didn't. Next thing I knew, I'm flying over the handlebars. I landed in the road with a graze on my hip, back wheel slightly bent. Thankfully, it wasn't a busy road, nothing coming, so I looked around. There wasn't anyone watching. My first thought, I stood up, I looked around, I said, did anyone see that? Ridiculous sight of someone just falling off his bike in the middle of the road. I didn't see anyone. I'd like to think someone might have seen me out their window and had a little chuckle at my expense. But anyway, it's an instinctive reaction, isn't it? When something happens to us, we look over our shoulder, did anyone see me? It happens when things go wrong. It also happens when things go well and we do things that are good. So another example, I used to play in a football team, an 11-a-side football team on a Saturday morning when I lived in Bristol. And occasionally, not very often, but occasionally, Hannah would come and watch and she might bring Chloe. And if I happened to do something good in the match, maybe scored a goal or made a good tackle, almost without thinking of it, my instinct would be over my shoulder. Did they see? And normally they didn't because they were doing something more interesting like playing. Chloe was about two at the time. That's the instinct, isn't it? And I think we all have that instinct wired in us deeply. We want to impress other people. We want other people to think we're great. People's opinions matter to us, don't they? It's just me. Do you know what I mean? Anyone else have this? I think it affects loads of what we do, actually. Look, the things we say in front of certain people, the way we say them, the things we wear, things we eat, things we watch and listen to, places we go, things we do in our spare time. Maybe you're someone who knows what it's like to be really ruled by these desires. And what people think of you really matters to you, and you think about it quite a lot, and it actually drives a lot of what you do. If you're that kind of person, you'll know, if you are, how deadly it can be. It can be deadly. To be in this place where your sense of worth, your security, your happiness depends on the opinions of others, depends on how impressive you are, how good you look to them. One little comment, either of approval or disapproval, one little glance can mean you're floating on cloud nine or you're on rock bottom. It's a deadly place to be. And it's this heart issue, that issue of living for show, that Jesus goes after next in his Sermon on the Mount. So we've been doing this series in the Sermon on the Mount. It's called the Jesus Blueprint. And we've been seeing how Jesus is taking us deeper. He's taking his disciples deeper. He wants us not just to do the right thing and obey the law. He wants our hearts. He's concerned not just with what we do, but why we do it. And in the passage we're going to look at today, we're going to think more about that motivation, the motivation for doing good that we have. So we've asked Luke to come and read it. So Luke, if you can come and join me, Luke's going to read the passage for us. It'll be on the screen. It's Matthew chapter 6, and say page 811 in these black Bibles, and verse 1 to 18. Thanks, Luke.
Chapter 6 of Matthew, giving to the needy. Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them, for then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. And your Father who sees you in secret will reward you. And when you pray, you must not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and in the street corners, that they may be seen by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you go pray, go into your room and shut the door and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees you in secret will reward you. And when you pray, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think that they will be heard for their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. Pray then like this. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For if you forgive others their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. And when you fast, do not look gloomy like the hypocrites, for they disfigure their faces, that their fasting may be seen by others. Truly I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, that your fasting may not be seen by others, but by your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you.
Great. Thank you, Luke. Thank you. So, start of chapter 6, the first word is beware. Jesus is warning his listeners. It's a warning. He's saying, if you're tempted to live to impress others, don't do it. There's no reward there. Just living out the Christian life, doing religious things to impress others will just leave you empty and insecure, actually. And what we're going to see as we work through this teaching from Jesus is that he offers a better way. He offers a way that's far more deep, far more rich, far more rewarding, far more satisfying, and far more freeing, actually, as well. So he goes after these three areas of religious practice, and in each of them, what he's saying is, don't do it for show, do it in secret. Three areas: giving, praying, and fasting. We'll look at them in turn. So first of all, Jesus says, give. Give in secret and not for show. Verse 2, thus when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you as the hypocrites do. They've received their reward. But when you give to the needy, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. So your giving may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. So Jesus starts by saying, when you give, he's assuming that his followers will be giving. It refers to giving money, not just money actually, but things, produce. Old Testament practice was that people in the country of Israel would give a tenth of what they gained, what they earned, what they grew, what they farmed, to the temple, to assist people who worked in the temple. Jesus talks here about giving to the needy. He's actually talking about giving that goes beyond just the tenth. And he assumes that kind of giving is going to be part of his disciples' response to God, part of their response to God's generosity to them. Now, before we go any further, just a side note, actually, to talk about giving. If you're a follower of Jesus, then he assumes you're giving too. These words are for you when you give. he assumes there's going to be a part of your regular income that goes to the work of God's kingdom. That's just part of being a disciple. So if you are a disciple of Jesus and you don't, then consider starting. Consider starting. It's a principle all the way through the Bible that God's kingdom ministry is funded by giving from Israel, from the church. That goes for TC as well. Everything we do here is funded by giving. If you're a guest here, please don't give. Please don't give. We're really glad you're here. If you're a regular, then do consider starting if you don't already. Not just because it's part of your discipleship, actually, but because it's part of your worship, part of joy. Responding to God's generosity by giving back to him is a joyful thing to do. That's a side bar. That's not Jesus' point here. Jesus' point here is that when you give, there is a right and a wrong way to do it. Okay? He's saying how you give matters. So he talks about the hypocrites sounding their trumpets before them in the synagogues and the streets. Now, we don't know if this actually happened, if the Pharisees actually sounded literal trumpets when they gave. I think Jesus is probably being metaphorical here. He's kind of painting this picture that's almost, it's so ridiculous, it's almost comical, of these religious people. They're walking into the temple treasury and they get these trumpets out and they make a big fanfare. What happens when you hear a trumpet? You come and see what's going on, don't you? They make a commotion. They create a crowd so there's someone to watch them when they put their money in the offering. Everyone can see them. Aren't I great? And Jesus goes after that attitude that they have when they give. So the word hypocrite actually means actor, someone who puts on a show, who puts on a face for people. And he's saying, you're doing this for performance. You're just giving for the sake of people who are watching. It's just a show. And Jesus says, if you give like this, then you've received your reward already. So, yeah, people are going to see you giving your coin into the offering. They're going to think you're impressive. The actor at the end of the show stands and the crowd applauds, and they take it, and that's their reward. It's the praise of men. It's people thinking you're great. But that's empty, and it's insecure. Because crowds are fickle, aren't they? They can change. There's no real solid reward in it. Instead, Jesus says, when you give, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. It's like a sort of over-the-top image. It's almost impossible to think about. How could my left, one part of my body, not know what my right hand is doing? And again, don't think Jesus means this literally, because you can't actually hide from yourself what you're doing unless you have some kind of split personality. I think what he's saying is, when you give, don't have an attitude of congratulating yourself. Don't give with your right hand, and then with your left hand, pat yourself on the back and go, well done me, well done me, great job, I gave, aren't I a good person? He's saying, give, and then forget you've given. Just don't go back there. Don't keep recalling it. Don't dwell on it to think about what a great, generous person you are. Don't pat yourself on the back. Give and forget. And Jesus says, if you give like this, then your Father, who sees in secret, will reward you. And we're going to come back to what that means later on. So, give in secret, not for show, that's the first thing. And secondly, pray in secret and not for show. That's verse 5-8. Jesus says, when you pray, you must not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners, that they may be seen by others. Truly I say to you, they've received their reward. But when you pray, go into your room and shut the door and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And when you pray, don't heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do. They think they'll be heard for their many words. Don't be like them. Your Father knows what you need before you ask him. Again, Jesus says, when you pray. So he assumes that his followers will be praying. Prayer is simply talking to God. It's very simple, talking to God. Practiced by people of all religions, but central, absolutely central to following Jesus. So he assumes if you're his follower that you'll pray, you'll be talking to God. But again, that's not the point. He's not saying pray. He's saying when you pray, there's a right and a wrong way to pray. So again, he goes after these hypocrites. He mentions the synagogue and the street corner. So in the synagogue, the way that prayer worked would be that it was led from the front, a bit like sometimes we have people here leading prayer from the front. It might be a different person each week, a member from the congregation. It was a real honour to be asked to stand up and pray in the synagogue, lead the prayers. And the kind of person Jesus has got in mind is the person from the synagogue who stands up. And he really wants people to think he's holy. So he prays, and he uses all kinds of flowery language, uses lots of impressive-sounding phrases, maybe quotes a lot from the Jewish scriptures, the Torah. And in his head he's thinking, I want to outdo the guy who prayed last week. I want people to think I'm really holy. I'm really good. And then street corners, less commonplace to pray, not a normal thing to happen for people to pray on street corners. I think what Jesus has in mind here is this idea that you might be stopped in the street at some point and have to pray. So there was a set time in the Jewish calendar, the afternoon sacrifice every day, daily sacrifice. And in Jerusalem, you'd be told when this was, perhaps a trumpet or a bell. And you could just arrange your movements so that you're in a place that happens to be the most public you can think of. At the time, you knew the afternoon sacrifice would be called, the bell goes, and you turn to the temple, and you stop what you're doing, make sure that everyone can see you. You raise your hands in prayer so that everyone sees, wow, he is holy. He loves God. He's a religious man. And Jesus says, pray like this, pray looking over your shoulder at who's watching, and you've received your reward. People might think you're impressive, might praise you, and that's it. That's your reward. Just don't be like that. Instead, when you pray, he says, go into your room, shut your door, and pray to your Father in secret. Now, I think this is a really searching test, actually, of the reality of our relationship with God. How much do you pray? How much do I pray when no one's watching? Searching, isn't it? I don't think Jesus is saying here, by the way, don't pray with others. There's plenty of examples in the Bible of praying with others. It's a really good thing to do. I think what he's saying is that prayer shouldn't just consist of public prayer. You shouldn't only ever pray with other people. You shouldn't pray for show. Because the heart of prayer is a relationship with God. The heart of prayer should be private. And private prayer should be the heart of your Christian life. It should be at the heart of who you are in the relationship with God. Robert Murray McShane, a famous Scottish preacher, says, what a man is on his knees before God, that he is, and nothing more. What a man is on his knees before God, that he is, and nothing more. What does this mean in practice? Find a place you can be alone with God. That's the first thing. Find a room. It doesn't actually need to be a room. It might be a physical room in your house with a particular chair where you go to pray. It might be a walk you go on every day or most days. It might be a particular seat on the train for your daily commute. The point is, you need to be able to close the door, metaphorically. You need to be able to close the door on that place so it's just you and God. And no one can walk in and distract you and disturb you. It's you and him on your own, cultivating a secret, private relationship with him. And go to that place every day. Go there regularly. Close the door and be on your own with your Father. And when you get there, what does Jesus say to do? He says, be real. So don't keep up phrases like the Gentiles do, that superstitious people who think that if I say a certain number of words in a certain order, then God has to hear me. Don't think that if you pray a certain phrase over and over again, or say a certain word a certain way, or in a certain book, or say a certain phrase that God's going to hear you sort of by automatically, as though he's some kind of machine. Speak to him like a friend. One of my favourite things to do, actually, is to pray with new Christians. Christians who haven't learned yet the kind of prayer language, you know, the kind of phrases that Christians know how to pray. I love it when you pray with someone who hasn't learned that language, and they just talk to God like he's their friend. I love it. It's so refreshing. That's how Jesus says we're meant to pray. Just lay your heart bare before God. Be totally honest with him. Jesus says, pray like this, and your Father, who sees in secret, he'll reward you. And we'll come back to what that means later. Right. That's number two, pray in secret. Number three, fast in secret. And not to show. That's verse 16. Jesus says, when you fast, do not look gloomy like the hypocrites. They disfigure their faces that their fasting may be seen by others. Truly I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, that your fasting may not be seen by others, but by your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you. Again, he says, when you fast. So he's assuming that his disciples are going to fast. Now, this isn't talked about much. We don't talk about fasting much in our church culture. So it needs a little bit more explanation. Okay? We kind of know what giving is. We know what prayer is. What's fasting? What's that all about? Okay, so fasting is going without food for a short, defined period of time for a spiritual purpose. Okay, when Jesus talks about, when the Bible talks about fasting, it's not talking about fasting for diet. Okay, fasting for health benefits, which is becoming a bit more trendy now. That's not what the Bible's talking about. It's talking about giving up food for a defined period of time for a spiritual purpose. Not just practical purpose, spiritual purpose. Lots of examples in the Bible of people fasting for all kinds of different reasons. Seeking God's guidance. Asking for deliverance from an enemy. Repenting over some sin, personal sin, corporate, national sin. Humbling yourself before God. Grieving over some evil in the world, some tragedy. It's not done regularly in the same way that giving and praying is. It's more a response to a specific situation in the Bible. And something Jesus says actually about fasting is interesting. People ask him about fasting. He says, how can the guests of the bridegroom fast when the bride was with him? That they can't, but when the bridegroom is taken, in that day they'll fast. Jesus says the bridegroom, he says, when I go, my followers are going to want to fast. He's assuming it's something we'll do as part of our discipleship. I think what he's getting at is that when we've seen Jesus here on earth, we've tasted a bit of what it's like to be part of his kingdom, to have him here, and then he's gone, that gives us a new reason for fasting, because we want him more. We want his kingdom to come. So what kind of situation might prompt a fast? Perhaps a recurring sin in your life, or a recurring sin in someone else's life that you love and care about. A tragedy in the world that you, that's particularly on your heart and weighs you down. A big life decision coming up. Doesn't have to be food that you fast from. So some people can't give up food for medical reasons. For some, it's just unhelpful. Could be another necessity that you voluntarily give up for a defined period of time. The point is you're denying yourself for a purpose, and it kind of intensifies your expression of need and desire for God. You're saying, I want you, God, and I want your kingdom to come in this situation more than I want food, or more than I want that other thing, whatever it is you're making. Jesus says, that's what I expect you to do as part of your following of me. But again, that's kind of a sidebar. Jesus isn't saying in this section, I want you to fast. He's assuming we will. He's saying, when you fast, again, there's a right and a wrong way to do it. How we fast matters. So, the Pharisees, they used to fast twice a week. They were really super religious. They went above and beyond the requirements. And when they fasted, there were some people in the Pharisees who really made sure that people knew it. So they would have gloomy faces, look really melancholy and sucking a sour lemon. They would smear dirt and ash on their faces. That's what Jesus talks about here. They disfigure their faces. Maybe put sackcloth over their heads. They just make sure people knew they were fasting. And Jesus says, if you fast in that way, then yeah, you've received your reward. Yeah. People might think you're very impressively spiritual and holy, but that's it. Jesus says, instead, when you fast, anoint and wash your face. Verse 17. Now, that's not a special thing to do. That's just normal kind of washing and cleanliness. So the point is, no one should know. When you fast, no one should know. So what might that mean for us? If you want to fast for some reason, choose a day when you can do it privately. Make it obvious that you're not saying no to food or whatever it is that you're giving up. Don't draw attention to yourself. Don't look sad or look hungry. And invite the question, oh, what's wrong with you? Oh, nothing, it's nothing. I'm just fasting, it's nothing. Don't make it obvious. Don't draw attention. Maybe a lunch break, go on a walk. No one knows if you're eating or not. Go on a walk and pray. And don't tell me you've done it. Don't tell me. It's you and God. Jesus says, fast like this, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. Okay, I've said twice, I'm going to come back to what that means. I'm not going to say it a third time. Let's think about what that means now. Your Father who sees in secret will reward you. What does that mean? For the Father to reward us. Okay. So there's two types of reward, I think. There's the reward that's kind of contractual. That where you get something for your performance, what you get is agreed on beforehand. Everyone knows, deal. There's not necessarily a connection with the thing you've done to earn it. So, for example, you're in a race. The agreement, the contract of that race is the person who wins the race gets a trophy. Or it could be a bag of sweets or a can of baked beans. You get something that's not related to your running as a prize. You win the race, get the medal. The other kind of reward is more relational. It's connected to what you've done to get it. So in the example of the race, you win the race, and what you get is respect for winning the race from your peers. That's the more relational kind of reward. Okay? Another example, you might have had reward charts for your children at some point, or been involved in setting reward charts for someone, maybe in your teaching career. There's a place for it. That's kind of contractual. Child performs well, gets a reward, whatever it is at the end of the week, a timeout, some money, whatever it is. The relational reward for a child behaving well is an improvement in the relationship, right? Behave well, we're going to be happier, and the home will be a happier place. Contractual, relational. And I think what Jesus is talking about here is the second time. Okay? He's not saying, if you live out your righteousness in secret, then you'll get some kind of spiritual tokens that can be cashed in either now or later for like a happy life or a nice car or something. He's not saying that. The reward of the Father for living out righteousness in secret, the reward is a deeper secret relationship with himself. That's the reward. Why do I say that? Well, if you're observant, you'll have noticed I skipped a bit. Okay, in the passage, it goes giving, prayer, and then there's a kind of interlude. Verse 9, Jesus says, pray then like this, and gives an example of how to pray. Then picks up verse 16 about fasting. It's kind of an interruption to the sequence. He's saying, don't do this for this reason, do this for that reason. And then he sort of interrupts to say, hey, here's how to pray. Why does he do that? I think it's there for a reason. I think it's there because prayer is where this relationship with God happens. And Jesus has been saying, do this, your Father will reward you, will reward you. I think what he's doing with the Lord's Prayer is saying, this is it. This is the reward. This is the blessing. Here's how to pray. Pray like this. And in this, there is strength. There is substance. There is depth. There's reality. There's life. There's joy. So we don't have time for detail in the Lord's Prayer. We actually preached the Lord's Prayer over 3 weeks in January. So if you weren't here or missed some, do go and listen to those messages. But I do want to show you just briefly how this prayer works and why it's such a gift. Because this prayer is such a gift to us. This is the reward, the relationship with our Father. So Jesus starts, he says, when you pray, adore God. The first thing is adoration. The Father in heaven, he says, hallowed be your name. So we think, we're praying to God as Father. He's brought me near to him. He's adopted me as his child. He's in heaven. He's over all. Adoring God takes our eyes off ourselves. And that's what we need more than anything. I was reading an author used the illustration of this part of the prayer, adoration. A bit like the difference between listening to something in audio and watching it in video. You listen to something in audio, just a talk, and it's fairly easy to be distracted, okay, by something around you. You're listening to it, but you can be looking at something else. If you're watching a video of something, it's a lot harder to be distracted because your eyes are taking it in as well as your ears. Okay, you're more immersed in it. And adoring, praising God in prayer, it's a bit like taking the truths that we know to be true about God from audio to video. You speak them out to God, you worship him. And it brings those truths to life in your heart. Isn't that what we need? We all need that. He starts with adoration, and then he goes accepting. Your kingdom come, your will be done. This is about letting go of thinking we know best. This is actually a scary prayer to pray, your will be done in my life. There's letting go of thinking we know the best and trying to be God. It's letting God be God. You may have had the experience of driving a car and having a child in the seat next to you. I don't know if you've ever had the experience where they've asked you to drive. I hope if they have, you said no, because you're a wise adult. And most wise adults will say that, because children can't drive. If the wise adult says no, and the child then tries to drive, comes over onto the adult's lap and sits on the seat and tries to move the steering wheel and get their feet on the pedals, what's going to happen? It causes problems. When a child tries to drive the car, what the child needs to do is to let the parent drive, and then the child can be at peace, because the parent knows how to do it safely. So many of our problems come from trying to drive. Trying to take the steering wheel of our lives. We're trying to be God. We're saying, I know best. It's a problem. I know what the problem is. And I'm sure I know what the solution is. And I'm just going to try and make that happen. We're trying to drive. And your kingdom come, your will be done, saying, do you know what? I'm going to let God drive. He's God, and I'm not. This prayer, this is the source of real peace. Real rest. We let God be God. The talk, accept, and then ask. Then we express our need to God. We say, give us this day our daily bread. Forgive me for my sin. Lead me not into temptation. We need these things every day. We need God's provision. We need his forgiveness. We need his protection every day. We pray this prayer and we're reminded we're not on our own. We're talking to a Father who loves to give, loves to help, loves to protect, loves to provide, loves to forgive. We're facing the day with him. Can you see? Just a really brief taste of the Lord's Prayer. Can you see how relating to God in this way, coming to the secret place, coming before him, is such a gift? Getting alone with your Father, actually connecting with him, worshipping him, accepting his will, asking him for his help. It just changes your perspective. It releases your desire to control. Receive his help. And the result of praying like this, might not see it straight away, but it's a bit like a tree putting down roots into the soil. It gives you something. Substance, strength, security. A security that's not dependent on other people and their opinions and whether you're impressing them that particular day. Security and a strength that can face trials. Even if your world is turned upside down, you can face them with peace and with trust, knowing your Father. Going to him in the secret. It's a place you can go to that no one can take away from you. Whatever happens in your life, you always have a secret place. You always have it. No one can take that away. And that means you can then give without having to worry about people seeing you. And you can then fast without people knowing. Because he sees, your Father sees, and he knows, and that's enough for you. Maybe you can think of someone in your life, maybe a godly Christian. And they just seem to exude inner peace and joy and strength. Maybe someone that you look up to. I don't know who you're thinking of, but I can tell you, if that person is a mature, godly Christian, this is their secret. Having a secret place with their Father. I don't know who they are, this is their secret. Maybe you like to read biographies of heroes of the faith who faced incredible challenges with courage, who made huge sacrifices for Jesus. I don't know who you're thinking of, who you've read about recently. I can tell you, this is their secret. Having a secret place with their Father, a deeper relationship with him. They've done it in secret, and he's rewarded them. This is their reward, himself. Living out the Christian life to impress others is just emptiness and insecurity. Living the life with your Father in secret brings true security and strength. Jesus says, don't do that. Do this. This is where the reward is. Before I finish, I want to just step back for a moment and ask ourselves one question. Why is Jesus saying this? It's a good question to ask when you read the Bible. Why is this here? Why is Jesus saying this? At one level, I think it's because he wants us to have reality in our practice of following him and not be fake. That's true. But why does this matter to God so much? Why did God choose to speak these words through his Son in this really important sermon? What does it reveal about God's heart? The fact that Jesus said, what does it reveal about God's heart? And the answer is, I think it shows that God wants relationship with you, with us. God's heart is he wants relationship in the secret. He wants an actual, genuine, back and forth, having a conversation, communicating with each other kind of relationship. With you. That's why Jesus said these words. He doesn't want your life to be for show. He wants a relationship with you. He wants to know you. He wants to meet you in secret. Because he loves you. You may be familiar with the mid-90s worship scene. If you're not, don't worry. If you are, you may know a song called In the Secret. Anyone know that song? In the Secret, in the Quiet Place, in the Stillness, you were there. Here it is on the screen. In the secret, in the quiet place, in the stillness, you are there. In the secret, in the quiet hour, I wait only for you, because I want to know you more. I had this song on my mind as I was preparing this message. And it's kind of a song from me to God. I'm talking to God. I want to know you. I want to see your face. And it's got me as the seeker. And God's out there. He's in the stillness. I need to get there. And when I get there, I need to wait for him until he shows up. So it's on me. I'm pursuing God. He's out there somewhere. I've got to get him. And I think there is something in that. There is something in that. I think it's we do need to be pursuing God. And there's a good cry of the heart that I want to know you more. I want to find you. I want to pursue you. But as I've thought about this, this isn't the main dynamic of Christian life. It's not the main thing. It's part of it. It's not the main thing. I think the main dynamic is the other way around. It's reversed. It's God saying to me, I'm in the secret place. I sing this song sometimes when I'm running. It's got quite a good beat and my sort of cadence of my steps. I like to sing the song the other way around. So here's the song, reversed. Not from me to God, but God to me. Just imagine these words now, and God speaking them to you. Just imagine it. In the secret, in the quiet place, in the stillness, I am here. In the secret, in the quiet hour, I wait. Only for you, because I want you to know me more. God's waiting. God's in the secret. He's waiting for me to come and meet with him. There's a great verse in the Song of Songs where the lover is talking to his beloved and he says, show me your face to his beloved. Let me hear your voice. Your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. Those kinds of words we generally put on our lips to God, right? Let me hear your voice. In fact, the chorus of the song literally says, I want to know you, I want to hear your voice, I want to see your face. The amazing thing is, in the Song of Songs, the one that the bridegroom refers to is Jesus, and we're the beloved. If you can take an analogy from the Song of Songs, what it would be is, God saying to us, show me your face. Let me hear your voice. Your voice is sweet, and your face is lovely. You ever thought? When you're thinking about, oh, do I pray today? Oh, do I go into my room and close the door? I'm just so tired, or I've got so many things to do. I haven't got time. And anyway, last time I prayed, I just got distracted. There's no point. Have you ever thought that if you go into that room and close that door, your presence might bless God's heart? Ever thought that? He's saying, show me your face. Let me hear your voice. This is the reward Jesus offers. For living out your life in secret. This is the reward. It's knowing his love. This is what we were created for. If you don't know him yet, this is what you were created for. You might not know it, but it is. We were created to know him and be loved by him. This is the meaning of life. This is what gives us that kind of deep security in a changing world, that kind of strength that will help us to face any trial. This is where it comes from. The Father wants you to come before him. He wants you to be yourself. He wants you to be real. He wants you to live for the audience of one, not the audience of many. And the reward that he offers is better than you can imagine. It's himself. Let me pray, and then we'll respond. Heavenly Father, we do thank you so much for your heart for us. Thank you for your heart to know us. That you want us to come to you in that secret place. And Father, I pray for each one of us here. Perhaps some who don't know you, who've never experienced that. that it might be something that they want to know more of. For those of us who perhaps have known you for many years, but who, if we're honest, our private prayer isn't really happening at the moment. Lord, I pray that, knowing that you are there, you are waiting, would draw us to you, knowing that you want us to know you, and you want us to have that reward of a deep and rich and real relationship. Lord, with that, draw each one of us to you this week. From wherever we are, draw us close to you. In Jesus' name.